Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press. State senators hold hearings here in Alaska on the price of gasoline. Paul, why and what are they hoping to accomplish as they look at the question of, are we paying too much at the pump?
I think why is it's an election year and the election's not very far off. And what they're finding is, yes, gas prices are high. Surprise, they've only been that way for a while. They've come up with they're trying to find a way to reduce gas prices at the pump to help motorists to buy votes. I mean, I'm being crass here, but that's where we're at. They want to.
Some people might find that exceptionally cynical.
Well,
but
I'm sorry,
but it's true.
Anyway, so they're toying with the idea. The idea has come up that they would hire a consultant for $150,000, and that they would also consider ideas such as spending up to $100 million to build a million-gallon gasoline holding tank somewhere in the tank farm on Government Hill. The idea being that the state would invest in all of this through ADA, and that the gasoline could be bought more cheaply, put in that tank, and then sold off to people like, or bought by and stored by, people like Costco and Fred Meyers and whatnot. That hopefully then would reduce the price of gasoline being produced in state by our two refineries, which are spend most of their time, it seems, making jet fuel. And they're running out of the very antiquated facilities, fired by oil, not natural gas, in a small market, and that's why the prices are up. And it's the same thing over and over
again. On the other hand, they have had consultants who've shown that the rate of growth has been outsized the rate of growth in other parts of the country in the prices.
But we spend, the price does. We actually use less gasoline than anywhere else in the country. I think the nearest state to us is 500 million gallons a year or something. We don't use very much gas. We've got high prices, and it goes back to they've repeated the factors again and again, small market, that sort of thing, and we're stuck with it.
Well, here's one other thing, Paul, that the prices are at the present time going down.
They're going down.
I keep track of this in my neighborhood. It was $4.44 not too long ago, and now it's $3.93. That'll make some people happy, or many people happy, but it seems like what people are really saying is a fair price should be about what I think it should be, and
it
no
should
more
be less
than
I'm paying, I'll tell you right
less
now.
Less than I'm paying, that's what we're looking for. Steve, can the government intervene here and really redirect prices?
I'm inclined to agree with my colleague and friend Paul over here in terms of the cynicism. It is an election year. I don't know what the government can do. This is not the first time the government has stepped in to try and do something about high gas prices, and they're always told, there's nothing really you can do. Maybe they can enact some sort of an emergency legislation. I don't know what they can do. It's the free enterprise system.
I guess part of what they can do is sort of shame the dealers. There's no question they try to do that.
But the dealers, I don't think the margin on a gallon of gasoline for the dealers is very much. I think that's why they're selling bread and Hostess Twinkies. You know, that's where they're making more of their money there. So I think those aren't the folks to go after. I don't think it's the price of oil is set on the world market. The price of gasoline comes after that, and it's just competition.
Who said that recently? Barack Obama, the President of the United States, more or less said there wasn't a whole lot he could do.
There's really not. And it is, they can be empathetic. Lawmakers can be empathetic. They got to drive too. And they're hearing a lot of complaints from their constituents as well. But there's really not a lot that these folks can do other than let people vent. I don't think they can do it. I think it's an election year. I think it's a good thing to do to get votes.
We sell our royalty oil to these enterprises. If we really wanted to reduce the cost of gasoline, one would think we'd reduce the cost, the price of the oil we sell to them. I understand the contract's close to being up. Maybe we could just slash the price we charge them, and they in turn would slash the price of gas. I don't think either is going to happen, but it was just a happy thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is sort of taking on the characteristic of New York City. In New York City, the rent's too high.
Yeah.
The people who run on that,
that's right.
That proposition, right? And so for us, a hardy perennial is the price of gas is too high.
And what adds to the frustration for Alaskans is we make the stuff here. You know, the stuff is under the ground, we bring it up. You know, you've got some refineries, it should be like, what, $1.50, right? But it's not. It's more expensive here than most places in the lower 48. That really angers a lot of us as well. But when you look at it, we have, what, about 850,000 people who live here in the state of Alaska?
730,
I added a few. So we don't have a whole heck of a lot of people. We don't drive. We don't have a whole lot of roads. So we're not big consumers of gasoline.
What has come up again in this thing, too, and always comes up as they look at gas, are we being gouged? Mm-hmm. Now, and they're toying with the idea of yet another investigation to find out if we're being. We've had two that I can remember, and I can't find any evidence.
No.
Okay, we need evidence enough of moving along here. Scott, the press has taken a lot of interest in the expansion of Ted Stevens International Airport and the conflicts the proposed expansion have presented. Why don't you run us through those conflicts? And you were just out there to take a walk last night, so you have firsthand experience with on-site.
Well, on-site because, frankly, a lot of us have been reporting incorrectly, and we get slammed down on the media message boards about this. There's a place called Voronzov Park, which the city owns and the airport is interested in. It's basically south of the sewer plant. Voronzov Park, there's no gate. There's no place for you to park. You access it by going through it on the coastal trail. So you won't really know you're in Voronzov Park. Where you are is on one of the wooded parts of the coastal trail. And there's a nice paved trail through the woods. This week, the assembly passed what's called the West Anchorage District Plan. And they passed it without making amendments to protect Voronzov Park from a land swap. The reason a land swap is in the works is because all around the airport there's various properties. Some are city-owned and some are airport-owned. Some of them are airport-owned but are actually de facto parks. We're already using them. The people use the trails.
The argument there would be that they just haven't been developed or used by the airport then, right?
Yeah, so based on the social trails that were there.
They're being stored, I guess you could say.
Yeah. They're being stored, banked by the airport. Mm. But if we were to trade one that they can develop, the city can get those de facto parks and have them and know that the airport won't encroach in these other places. It would be a complicated, comprehensive land swap. And at the moment, there's no telling whether Voronzov Park will be a part of it or not.
Okay. And how long does this process have to take?
Oh. I guess as long as the airport's there, they have what's called a master plan. They're like a little city in themselves. They're owned by DOT, though. They're not owned by us, or they're not owned by Anchorage. So they have a master plan, and as they make progress, they'll replace their master plan periodically. And people can watch, in this case, people can watch the West Anchorage District Plan and watch the Anchorage Airport, the Ted Stevens International Airport Master Plan, and see if things are matching up.
Okay, thank you very much, Scott. Steve, the Mount Marathon race in Seward has endured a tragedy and now a certain amount of controversy and questions about the conduct of the race. A runner is still missing. Tell us about Michael Lemaitre, and what does his disappearance mean for the future of the race?
Well, it's a very sad story. Michael Lemaitre, kind of an adventurous spirit, 66-year-old man from Anchorage here, ran in his very first Mount Marathon on the 4th of July. This is the first time he was on the mountain. He was last seen about 200 feet from the top of the 3,000-foot mountain, and appeared to be in good spirits, sounded like he was in good spirits. One of the race officials saw him there, and then he was going to continue up. This race official was coming down. It was a timekeeper from up on the top. Hours pass, his family grows more and more concerned, alerts the race officials and said to tell them that my husband's not come back yet, so a search is launched. Still have not found him at this particular point. It's a very, very sad story. Also, during the race, a very good runner, very elite Mount Marathon runner, slips and falls at the base of the mountain where there's a rocky cliff area, hits his head and fractures his skull. Very serious injury. So he's in the hospital, he's being treated, and we hope the outcome obviously is favorable for him. This has prompted a lot of talk about changing some of the rules of the race, how basically the race runs itself. There's been some suggestions of putting sweepers, people who will walk up the mountain behind the last place runners and just basically follow them through the whole process and actually come down with them, but make sure nobody's left behind, nobody is stranded. There's also a proposal out there that once the you reach the halfway point up on the summit of the mountain, if you are not there by a certain point, or maybe the halfway point of the mountain, if you're not there by a
like
certain
the
amount
Iditarod.
Of time, yeah, your bib is pulled and you're sent home. You're not going to be able to continue on. So,
Steve, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go right
to the question. I've received some emails and comments from people, and there's some criticism that the race has just gotten so big and so, in effect, professional that it needs to be more professionally run. Is there anything to that line of criticism in your judgment?
Well, I don't know about that. They've been doing it for a long time, and sometimes, and I'm not saying that this is the case here, people grow complacent. And perhaps you hate to have something like this shake you out of your complacency, if that is indeed the case here. But this has happened, and now it's time to perhaps look at the procedures that are being used to run this race. So the race has gone off. There's a certain amount of danger to it.
Right.
We covered the race. There was a promo where someone says, if you're not bleeding when you come off the mountain, you didn't try hard enough. So I think it's sort of a badge of honor to come up bashed and bruised a little bit. But at the same time, there are people who slip and fall. They injure themselves. It's a mountain. It's a scramble up a mountain at certain points. Rocks come flying out. We've seen many people who've gotten a rock right in the face. Those kinds of things have happened. People have fallen before and been injured. But when you sign up for that race, you have to realize that there is a certain amount of danger, and that appeals to a lot of folks.
And there's some members of the public who are thinking, asking, how does a runner disappear in front of this huge audience, which is waiting for him to return?
That's a really good question. That's baffled me right from the start. How? It's not like there's glaciers and crevasses up there or anything like that you could fall into, but it's a very heavily wooded area, and who knows? It's just frightening. You're talking about the race has gotten too big. They do keep a very strict limit on the number of people who are allowed to be up on that mountain for safety reasons. They have split. There's an A and a B section in the men's race that goes up. I'm not sure if there's an A and a B in the women's race, but they stagger the start at least for the men. So they can keep enough people in the race, but at the same time, they're not overwhelming that mountain. Also, there's not like one trail that you go up and come down.
Yeah,
you're kind of all over that one face of the mountain. You're going through woods, and some people everybody chooses their own path that they'd like to go up. So it's a different kind of race, and it's something that is very uniquely Alaskan. And I think people are going to have to realize that there is this element of danger if they want to sign up for it.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Scott Christensen. Paul, Shell Oil moves ahead with Arctic development, but it's sued. Please explain, what is Shell doing for the rest of the summer by way of Arctic oil development?
A coalition of environmental groups, the Alaska Wilderness League, the Center for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, have joined up to sue the federal agencies involved, saying they were too quick to approve Shell's spill response plan, that they in fact rubber stamped it. This lawsuit is not aimed at what goes on this year. It's aimed at what's going to go on in years to come. They're going to challenge the spill response plan, and if they win, or whatever the outcome, it won't have any effect on this year. Shell this year, because of ice conditions, is probably going to sit out the summer or be staging during the summer. Its first opportunity to drill will be sometime in August, I suppose.
And we'll hear more about that
as the summer goes on. Yeah, okay. They're starting to stage. We've got vessels going into Alaska, and they're trying to get a permit, a modification on one of their vessels for emissions and that sort of thing. So that'll be taken care of this summer, and then probably in August.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Scott, the Alaska Dome, which bills itself as the world, the largest air-supported sports facility on the North American continent, wants tax relief. First, describe the dome and remind us who uses it and for what purposes, and tell us what's the tax controversy or concern here.
Well, the dome is built in West Anchorage. Team sports use it, especially soccer. It's popular in soccer. There's also a 400-meter, six-lane running track around the field in there, so you can do real foot races in there. There's batting cages and pitching cages for baseball and other amenities, some weightlifting equipment, I believe, for cross training, for people who's training. It's an interesting story. They are getting some tax relief. The city appraisers agreed to lower the value of the building itself from $9.5 million down to about $250,000.
That's quite a
jump.
It is, and in fact, Marty McGee, the appraiser, I asked him if he had ever seen anyone, any movement that far, and he said he hadn't, and he's been in the business about 15 years.
And who owns this facility?
Well, it owns itself. It's a nonprofit. It was founded by another nonprofit. It was founded by Change Points, the West Anchorage Church. Change Point founded it through an economic development arm that they have. However, now it's completely independent. They have an independent board and they're a standalone nonprofit. They sort of have positive cash flow, but they have debt issues. The construction of this thing, it never paid for itself.
And they presumably, all these people who use it have to pay some kind of fee, right? Whether it's as a team or individually or whatever it is, right?
But they've also tried to extend free programs to other nonprofits. So there's some like health related programs that have that have been able to extend free programs to. I don't know many details about that. I've just seen it in memos that people from the Dome wrote to the legislature. The appraiser, it's important to know that the reason the value of the building went down so far is that they switched from an analysis that studied the cost of the building to an analysis that studies the market and what this building would be worth if you were to sell it. And what the city had to do to come to this, to agree to this, is the owners of the Dome, the sports Anchorage Sportsplex, the nonprofit, they are made an argument that said there are no other uses for this building. The previous appraisal, saying this is worth $9 million, always assumed that this could be a large industrial warehouse. The fact is, if you have trucks coming and going from an inflatable building, it's going to deflate because the doors will be open too tight.
And this in some ways, is reminiscent of the argument about Yankee Stadium. What would be an alternative purpose for Yankee Stadium, right?
Yeah, there is no alternative purpose. And for that reason, you can do this market-based analysis and you basically take away a large group of would-be buyers.
And do you have any sense of how much revenue goes through there every year? I mean, we're talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions to make this public, or?
You can find it through their 990 filings, but I haven't taken strict notes about their finances, partly because they went through bankruptcy before, and this is the nonprofit that is emerging from bankruptcy. So that stuff is pretty. It's available for reporters. I just simply haven't. I haven't got to the level of understanding.
And the debt that we're talking about here, as you understand it, is construction debt rather than operating debt. Is that
right?
Correct?
It's construction.
Real problems with the foundation of that.
Go ahead,
building.
Steve. Take
They had real problems during the construction where they basically had to start over. It really set them back, put them in the hole in a big way. But yeah, they had some pretty big problems that popped up during the initial construction phase of this thing. So they've been trying to catch up.
Want to add something there, Scott?
Yeah. Well, I know that operations are cash cash positive, both from the study by the independent appraiser that they hired, talked about it. So operations costs are paying for themselves. It's the debt service that's the problem. Okay. And this year, they had another small victory. The Alaska legislature gave them $1.5 million to bring their parking lot up to city codes, to basically pavement. This is going to help users who are in wheelchairs or walkers. It's going to increase the number of people they can serve, because there were people who, in wintertime, which is prime time inside the dome, couldn't make it across the parking lot.
Okay. Steve McDonald, a number of Senate Republicans or candidates for the Senate mm-hmm. are campaigning against the coalition, the yeah. mix of Republicans and Democrats who have run the Senate in recent years. Ralph Seekins, for example, in mm-hmm. Fairbanks, has brought up the coalition, and there have been candidates here in Anchorage who have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. What's the concern of these Republicans, and who's the audience for this argument?
Well, the state Senate, Alaska State Senate, is 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats, so they're split right down the middle. 20 members, 10 and 10, so to get things done, the Republicans and the Democrats merged to become a coalition of sorts, become a coalition. And Democrats hold some key seats in the leadership, as well as Republicans. And they've gotten together to make some very big decisions during the last couple of legislative sessions, including the House's plans for an in-state gas line. They blocked it. The proposal by the governor to cut oil taxes to try and
right,
spur
right.
production, right. They blocked that as well. They also have passed things too. The Tea Party candidates basically have come out and said, we don't want to have coalitions. We want to have conservative Republican views promoted in the Senate, and we want to move towards those views. We feel that compromising with the Democrats is just not beneficial
to our
cause. Well,
then how do they react to all these Democrats, half a dozen or whatever, who are in the House majority?
Yeah,
Republican majority.
Yeah, it's not quite that. More Republicans. There's like 22 Republicans in the 40-member House, so Republicans have the majority there, and they pretty much run things. It just doesn't get. It's not quite the coalition that you see in the Senate. The Senate, in order to move something forward, is cut right down the middle, 10
right,
and 10.
Right.
So the House, it's still run by Republicans. It's probably not considered conservative enough either by Tea Party supporters. You've got people like Mike Dunleavy, who's running against Linda Menard in the Valley.
As a conservative Republican.
Who basically says Senator Menard is a rhino, a Republican in name only. She's not a true Republican. She's not conservative enough. You need somebody in there with conservative values. And these are the Tea Party backers basically feel that they should not be, hanging out with the Democrats.
With the wrong
or whatever.
Crowd.
Yeah, yeah. There should not be any compromising going
Paul,
on.
Paul, what can you add here?
I think it's more than just Tea Party people. I think that the more conservative side mm-hmm. of the Republican Party, not necessarily just the Tea Party, are angry that people that they elected as Republicans are consorting with Democrats.
Yeah, how dare
and I think they're angry about that. They figure, well, we voted for people who said they were Republicans. We want to see Republican values. We want to see Republican votes. And that's where a lot of the anger comes from.
How do you do that if you have 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans?
Well, they would rather see them butt heads and get nothing done. Essentially,
like
they got nothing done anyway. Yeah, they've managed to get there anyway. So, yeah. I don't know. And the Democrats in the House that joined, they're the good Democrats.
Yeah. Just very briefly, Steve here, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about this is if you're Bert Stedman of Sitka or mm-hmm. Gary Stevens of Kodiak, your Republican
right.
senators,
right.
Am I going to join up with a Republican Senate that's going to be organized by somebody else that's going to put me at the bottom of the committee system just to be a purist? I don't get this.
I guess, I think you got to start somewhere. So the hope is that if you get a foothold in the Senate, then 4 years from now or whatever, the more senators are up for a re-election, you get
far
a couple
more
in there.
Far be it for me to have influence. I'd rather be a pure Republican. I guess that's the deal.
Well, I think would happen is they would just sit and butt heads. And, I really believe you'll find people that would rather see that.
Well,
they
have to pass the budget. There has to be some kind of organization.
Yeah. What the coalition looked at, and you brought up Gary Stevens. Gary Stevens is looked at as a moderate Republican. Right. And what they looked at is they just said that, we represent the middle. That's where most Alaskans are. They're in the middle. They're not to the far right. They're not to the far left. They're right in the middle. And this coalition represents the bulk majority of Alaskans and their beliefs.
We're in the middle of running out of time. Scott, quickly, final thoughts from the press on the municipal election.
There are two reports that come out, one from retired Judge Dan Hensley, another from the Group of 10 voters. Group of 10 voters report claims to have found 20 different violations of local city election code. That's something that the assembly members will be thinking about as they move to election reforms, whether to change the code, whether to keep all the reforms internal to a better managed clerk's office.
And the group of 10 was a citizens group.
Yeah, it's a citizens group. These alleged 20 violations, they'll never be litigated, so no judge will have to decide if we broke the law.
Okay, before we part, I have one thought of my own. Schaefer Cox, the leader of the militiamen defendants in the militiamen case here in Fairbanks Federal Court, fired his attorney, Nelson Traverso of Fairbanks. Apparently he's looking for another attorney or will defend himself. This was not unexpected. There'd been a certain amount of tension that was evident during the course of the trial between the defendant and his attorney. Traverso did not talk about this and has not talked about this beyond what was required of him legally and in some cases with the judge. But we have another saga here awaiting us with Schaefer Cox. Thank you.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.